Did you know a 2018 study showed half of prenatal vitamins tested had unacceptable levels of heavy metals? I'm Kat, mother of three and founder of Ritual. When I was 4 months pregnant, I couldn't find a prenatal I could trust, so I created my own. Ours is made traceable, third-party tested for heavy metals, and recently earned the Purity Award from the Clean Label Project. But don't just take my word for it. Get 25% off at ritual.com/prenatal. Did you know a 2018 study showed half of prenatal vitamins tested had unacceptable levels of heavy metals? I'm Kat, mother of three and founder of Ritual. When I was 4 months pregnant, I couldn't find a prenatal I could trust, so I created my own. Ours is made traceable, third-party tested for heavy metals, and recently earned the Purity Award from the Clean Label Project. But don't just take my word for it. Get 25% off at ritual.com/podcast.
Sixty years since Betty and Barney Hill had a close encounter, subsequent abduction in New Hampshire's White Mountain. Today, the niece of Betty Hill, Kathleen Marden, has become one of the leading ufologists in the industry. Her book titled Captured, The Betty and Barney Hill UFO Experience, will talk about 60 years of research, abductions, UFO encounters, and much more. And we're going to talk about her work with nuclear physicist Stanton T. Friedman. I'm Tony Sweet with Truth Be Told. We want to welcome back to the Truth Be Told studios the one and only Kathleen Marden.
Good to be with you again, Tony.
It's been a while, and I hope you've been well. You look amazing.
Oh, thank you.
And I'm excited to have you here. I can't believe we're talking about the 60th year since the experience.
That is just unbelievable to me. That's wow.
Yeah, in
the
fact,
time has passed very quickly.
I know. Well, I'd like to recap a little bit for some of our listeners that may not know your aunt's story, and then we'll get into your own story because you had some your own experiences. And I'd like to start with who Betty and Barney Hill were.
My Aunt Betty Hill was a social worker for the state of New Hampshire. She worked in child welfare and adoption. And Barney was a post office worker. He had been a truck driver for the post office in Philadelphia. And he and Betty had met in 1956. They married in 1960. And he was finally transferred to Portsmouth, New Hampshire in 1961, early in the year. So he could finally live with his wife. So Betty and Barney were just probably the epitome of what people should be. They were kind, they were compassionate. They were civil rights activists. That's what caused them to be so interested in one another. And they had never intended to fall in love, but it was their mutual interest in civil rights and in human rights. You know, Barney was Black, had grown up under a segregated system, spent a lot of time in the state of Virginia when he was a boy. Was living in Philadelphia when he met Betty. They met at the beach.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, Betty had finished college at that time, and he was at the beach, and they were talking, and she said, well, she had an apartment house, and she kept an apartment for short-term rentals. So if he ever wanted to come back, that she could rent an apartment to him. And so he did. And they developed a friendship. They had so many interests in common Both were highly intelligent. Barney's IQ was 140.
Oh, wow.
Betty did not know what hers was, but hers was at least that high, I would think. She had a photographic memory when she was young. She was a very good student. When she was in elementary school, she went to a one-room schoolhouse in Kingston, New Hampshire, growing up in a farming community. And she was appointed by the teacher to teach the younger children when she was what probably was like fifth grade and beyond, until she went on to high school. And then after that, she went to the University of New Hampshire and was a social work major. Barney wanted to go to college. He wanted to be an engineer, to study engineering, but he didn't have those opportunities. He suffered from social strife as a result of the color of his skin. And it was definitely a system that was not fair to either of them. At the time that their story was released to the public as the result of a violation of confidentiality, Barney had been appointed to the U.S. Commission on Civil Rights as a state advisory member for the state of New Hampshire. He had also received a commendation from Sergeant Shriver, and who headed up the federal poverty program. And also the governor of New Hampshire for setting up the Rockingham County Community Action Program with funding from the federal government, the Office of Economic Opportunity. And he was a volunteer chairman of the first board of directors for that organization. Betty was side by side with him. Barney was in the NAACP, so was Betty. Barney served on the regional board as legal redress and on the local board as well. And I just can't say enough about him. We were invited to the presidential inauguration in 1965, the violation of confidentiality, and the three of us went. I was invited because Betty and Barney were really mentors for me. They were a wonderful aunt and uncle who looked out for all of the children in the family and made all of us feel important and want to excel in what we did. So they were just very good role models.
Though I'm glad you're telling the background, because for some people, like you said, they may know the story, not who the people were.
Yes.
And they weren't just, you know, people that you would think would make something up just for attention, because somebody of that, both of them of that caliber of intelligence, I don't think would even want to bring attention to themselves other than their activism, or, you know, examples of, you know, who they were as a married couple, but not for what they're actually known for in the ufology world.
Yes, that's very true. And they did not want to bring that kind of attention to themselves because of the important positions that they were holding in their city, in their county, and in the state of New Hampshire. They were becoming well known, and they even were advocates and worked on a literacy program. Mm. Because back in those days, you had to pass a literacy test to vote. And so they were working on that as well.
All right. Well, let's get into, we got to know who they were. We'll get into, you know, like I said, your story in a minute. But tell us the story of what made them, at least in the ufology world, famous. I mean, everybody in this industry knows who Betty and Barney Hill are.
Betty and Barney had an encounter, a close encounter with a UFO when they were traveling home from a short vacation to Niagara Falls and up to Toronto and over to Montreal over a to a 3-day period, and spent a wonderful afternoon in Montreal. They intended to stop for the night at a motel on the outskirts of the city because they had their dog, Delcy, with them. She was a dachshund. And so Delcy, her presence would not get them a room in downtown Montreal at one of the better hotels. So if they were going to stay in Montreal, they needed to go to the outskirts. Well, all of the signs were in French, and as Betty, as Barney was driving, Betty knew a little French, but not enough. And so as Barney was driving, they ended up on the road that took them back to New Hampshire. And so they decided that they would just continue on. Neither was tired. It had a wonderful day. And they stopped and went sightseeing along the way, and had a great time for themselves. They arrived in New Hampshire at a little before 10 o'clock at night, and stopped at a restaurant and had a cup of coffee and a little bit to eat. It was 10:05 when they left. They set their watches and wound their watches and expected to arrive home at between 2 and 3 o'clock in the morning. So as they're driving, there is this unconventional craft that comes closer and closer and closer. It is it is 1.5 to 2 times the length of the Old Man of the Mountains profile. They knew that because it hovered next to the profile, and the profile of the Old Man of the Mountain is 48 feet from forehead to chin. It's just a rock formation that was the state of New Hampshire's symbol, but fell off the mountain in 2003, unfortunately. So from there, they continued to drive south. The craft was coming in closer and closer. And finally, it came down over Route 3, the highway they were traveling on, and hovered only 200 feet above them, above their car. Barney had to stop the car in the middle of the road so that he wouldn't drive underneath the craft.
Oh, that would be scary.
Yeah, it would. I know what happens to people who
to do that,
drive underneath those craft.
I was going to say, right behind me.
Yes. It's happened to cars, too, in some cases.
Oh, wow.
So Barney stopped the car. He was a confirmed skeptic. He did not believe in that UFOs or extraterrestrials could ever come to this planet. He thought the whole thing was nonsense. So he was going to prove to Betty that this was conventional. But so he got up out of the car. He had his binoculars, and he's looking up at this, and he sees that it is silent, that it is disc-shaped. He described it as looking like a large pancake just hanging there, only a couple of hundred feet up in the air, and then it descends, and he steps back, and when he does, it moves to an adjacent field on the other side of the road. And when that happened, he followed it with his binoculars, move up to his eyes, shaking his head,
like
pulling
me.
The binoculars down, saying, "This can't be real." But it was real. And so he walked toward this craft, and through the binoculars, he observed several figures dressed in black, shiny uniforms. He could see them when they all but one moved to what looked like a panel on the back of the corridor that was encircling this front part of the craft. And when and one remained at the window. But when the other's hands went up into the air, and Barney could observe them from the tops of their heads down to about their knees, there were little red lights that started to slide out from the craft. There were two of them. And then something started to drop down from underneath the craft.
Here we go.
Barney said You know, he thought it might be a rope, but no, it wasn't a rope. and we know what it is because, you know, that's the carrier beam that takes those little ETs down to you and helps you into that beam so that you dematerialize and rematerialize up in the craft. So Barney became terrified at that point because even though he thought it was a rope, maybe, he, on the face of that leader, he felt that there was a plan, and that plan was to capture him a bug in a net, he said. So he pulled the binoculars from his eyes so forcefully that he broke the leather strap. He ran back to the car. He'd left it running. He left the door open, and he got into the craft boat. Into the car. But as he did, he saw the craft coming in his direction.
Have you heard about the 2018 study that showed half of prenatal vitamins tested had unacceptable levels of heavy metals? No? Well, now you have. I'm Kat, mother of three and founder of Ritual, the company making traceability the new standard in the supplement industry. I remember staring at my prenatal vitamins and finding all these things I was trying to avoid. High amounts of heavy metals, synthetic colorants, and unnecessary ingredients. So, at 4 months pregnant, I quit my job and started Ritual because I believe that all women deserve to know what they're putting in their bodies and why. I'm so proud of our prenatal vitamin. The ingredients are 100% traceable, it's third-party tested for microbes and heavy metals, and recently received the Purity Award from the Clean Label Project. You see, we trace like a mother because, let's be honest, no one cares quite like a mother. But don't just take my word for it. Trace for yourself with 25% off at ritual.com/podcast.
And so he went speeding down the highway, trying to get away from this craft. And he said to Betty, finally, "Betty, roll down your window and look up and see if that craft is above us." So she did. She was looking for lights. All she saw was blackness, even though it was a bright light night. Moon was about three quarters full. And she rolled the window back up, and moments later, they heard a series of code-like buzzing sounds striking the trunk of their car. When that happened, the car began to vibrate, and they felt a tingling sensation pass through their bodies. Anyone who is an experiencer listening knows what that tingling sensation is like. And the next thing they knew, they were 35 miles down the highway. They had vague memories of encountering a roadblock, of finding themselves on a dirt road in an area that was very rural with tall trees all around. They remembered this large fiery orb that seemed to be sitting on the ground. And then there they are. There's another series of buzzing sounds. They're 35 miles down the highway. And Betty turns to Barney and says, "Now do you believe in flying saucers?" And he says, "Don't be ridiculous, Betty. There's no such thing as flying saucers."
Even after that?
And, well, she thought he was just giving her a hard time, which he liked to do. He liked to kid her
right.
a lot. He said, "Don't be ridiculous, Betty," so many times in my childhood, just kidding her along. And but he did say, "I can prove that I can make that sound, that buzzing sound." So he stopped the car. He drove it from one side of the road to another. He did everything to attempt to recreate that sound, and he couldn't do it. So they just drove on home to their house on the seacoast of New Hampshire in the city of Portsmouth. Barney was looking for a police officer. He wanted to report this. And Betty was looking for a restaurant that was open.
So that she's like, "I'm hungry."
Yeah. Well, they wanted human contact.
Right.
They said they wanted human contact. So they arrived home, but by the time they arrived home, it was already dawn was breaking. And so it wasn't 2 to 3 o'clock in the morning. The watch that Betty was wearing
stopped.
That night says 5:15.
Wow.
And both of their watches had stopped working and never ran again. So I think they went into the house, they set their watches thinking they just needed to wind them again, and they never ran again.
Did they keep those watches?
I have Betty's watch.
Oh, you do?
Yes, when I die, it will go to the University of New Hampshire, but I have it now.
Well, it kind of reminded me of a story when I was driving back from Kansas, where I'm from, and originally, and then coming back to California, and my dad had purchased this painting, and it was painted by a Navajo artist. And so I wanted to find out if it was real or whatever. So I stopped at the Navajo Museum in Arizona. And as we were talking, I told her, what kind of show I do. And she's like, she was the curator for the museum. Mm-hmm. And she was like, I had an experience once. And it was an experience where she was young, her grandmother, her mother, everybody was out in the yard, in Arizona on the reservation. And she said they all looked up and they saw this disc floating, but it was close enough to where they could actually see through, I guess, their windows. I didn't even think there would be windows, but they said they could see windows of small looking creatures in the window looking at them. And of course, then it took off and disappeared. But so it reminded me of what you were saying that Barney had seen.
Yes. And, it's pretty prevalent among Native Americans. That statistically is one of the groups that have a high percentage of contact with non-humans.
Yeah. Yeah. So I find that fascinating. So you said, go ahead. I'm sorry.
The sky people. I think that's
sky people. Yes.
Sky people. Yes.
Yes. Well, that's, so they go get back to town. Barney wants to get a hold of a police officer. Betty wants to get some food. They want to get some human contact. But back then, a lot of times people, they would call in to the police department or whatever, but some people would just say, I don't know what we just saw, so let's not say anything at all.
That's what Barney said to Betty.
Right, right.
They had a lot of evidence that something had happened, but Barney said, Betty, I don't want to ever tell anyone about this. No good can come of it.
Right.
And so he said that, and she walked to the phone and called my mother.
Oh, of course. Mama always has to know.
Oh, yes. My mother was Betty's younger sister, 10 years younger than Betty. And my mother had a sighting way back in 1958.
Oh, so she saw one too.
Yes. I didn't know it until that day. There was no interest in UFOs in my family, as far as I knew. And I was 13. And my mother went grocery shopping every Friday night. And one of those nights, she was with another aunt of mine. And there was this huge cigar-shaped craft hovering over a field that they went by. Hmm. They stopped the car. They had family friends who lived across the street from that field. So they went to their house and they went out too and observed it. There were smaller craft that were near that larger one.
Right.
And either coming out or entering in. By the time I interviewed my mother about it, she couldn't remember if they were just coming out, flying around, or were actually going back into that craft. But she had a sighting, and I heard about it when I was 13 on that fateful day. So I really got an education on that day.
So back in the day, I was born in 69. In fact, my sister was born in 61. But back then, I remember when Orson Welles did that infamous radio broadcast, and it scared the bejesus out of America.
Yes.
In the 60s, and then in 40s, 47, we heard of Roswell, and then, maybe some other encounters. But back then, compared to today, how was people's reaction? Like now we're like, oh my gosh, that's interesting. Tell me your story. What was 61 like? Or
well, back in 47, there was a lot of interest across the United States, around the world. These craft were being seen and reported in the news. But then there was a Robertson panel in 1953 who set up a plan. It was the CIA-funded Robertson panel who set up a plan to dissuade the American public from having an interest in these craft. It didn't work very well. But by 1961, no UFO abduction case had ever been scientifically investigated. And so Betty and Barney were instructed to call Pease Air Force Base by my father's best friend, who had been the chief of police in the small town of Newton, New Hampshire, right next to the town that I grew up in. And so, being good citizens, Betty and Barney called Pease, and they made a report, Project Blue Book report, and then Betty went to the Portsmouth Public Library because she wanted to learn more. She'd never read a book on UFOs, despite what the disinformants say.
Right.
And there was an address in the book, and it was an address for NICAP. And so Betty and Barney sat down. Betty typed a letter out to NICAP with their report of the close encounter and the non-humans that were they could see. She didn't say non-humans. She said that they were dressed in black shiny uniforms, and they were frightened Barney so badly that he developed a mental block for their faces.
Oh, almost like a PTSD.
They did develop what we call PTSD today, eventually, yes. That was the start of it. And they made the report to NICAP. Walter Webb, an astronomer from the Hayden Planetarium in Boston, went up and interviewed the Hills separately and together for a period of 6 hours, took notes on what they said, and wrote a confidential report for NICAP.
When I was a kid, and back 70, I was born, like I said, 69, so it was probably 77, 78. I was really young. My mom, my sisters, I have two sisters and a brother, we were driving out in the country because I'm from a very small town in Kansas, very small, 200 people. And there, at that time, there were a lot of UFO sightings in that area. Don't know why, but you know how sometimes there's certain decades that UFOs show up more than other decades or years. So we were driving home. It was dark, and I don't really remember it because I was so young, but my mom, my sisters, my brother, they were quite a bit older than I was. We saw a UFO disc, no noise, hovering over a lake. Mom stopped and said we were scared. She said I yelled, I want to go with him, but I don't know if that was true or not. but she apparently, and then a small plane came by, a prop plane or a single engine plane, turned around and came back. They must have saw it, and when it came back, the craft flew straight up in the air and disappeared. I didn't remember this. My mom never told me this part, but my sister said, my mom the next day called McConnell Air Force Base in Wichita, Kansas. Apparently they came down and went and researched the area that we saw the UFO. This is what my sister said. And she said she remembered, at that night when she went to sleep, she had a dream of aliens trying to take her. Well, she said she woke up in the morning, she had her socks on, and they were soaking wet, like she had walked through water. And you said that Barney and Betty had some missing time. Was that an abduction? And Did they ever in their lifetime, because I know he died in what, 69 or something like that?
Yes, he did.
So fairly young, but
46.
That's young. In their time, did they remember anything about the abduction?
They began to remember more than they did initially. They were looking almost immediately for a hypnotherapist who could hypnotize Barney because of problems that he was having. And they ended up going to Dr. Quirk. And Dr. Quirk said that he did not want to hypnotize them at that time because he thought that they would remember more as time went on. But as time went on, Barney developed psychogenically induced physiological symptoms. He wasn't able to sleep at night. He was very anxious. He had developed bleeding ulcers. He had to take a 3-month leave of absence from work. It was a life-threatening condition.
Wow.
Yeah. And it was just really eating at him. And finally, he was referred to Dr. Benjamin Simon, because Dr. Simon was a neuropsychiatrist who had developed a very specialized technique in working with people who were suffering from what they then called conversion hysteria. And that was what he treated many people returning from the war front in World War II for. And there was a movie made about his work called Let There Be Light. It was a John Huston movie. And he had a great deal of success, whereas other psychiatrists did not, in working with these people who were so damaged by the war psychologically.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
And so what he did was let me give you an example.
Sure.
In the movie, it showed a man who was wheeled in a wheelchair. He was blind, and Dr. Simon hypnotized him. He went through what happened. He saw his best friend killed in the war. And is that what led to his blindness? Dr. Simon told him, now, you know, get up and you can see. And he couldn't see.
Oh, wow.
Dr. Simon had a technique of getting to the crux of the matter. What else in this soldier's life caused a combination of these traumas that created this physiological problem for him? And what had happened is, a couple of weeks earlier, this young man's sweetheart had written to him. It was a Dear John letter that she was calling off their relationship. So once they worked through that trauma, and the two of them combined, the young man could see again. And in the movie, you saw him playing baseball and then boarding the bus to go home to his family. So it was a great work that Dr. Simon did. He was nationally recognized. He was the head of Psychiatric Association. He won medals during World War II for his work. He was a colonel in the army.
Right.
And so he did, he really did a lot. And so he was the person that Barney needed to see.
That's great. And it you know, sometimes that perfect timing when, you know, when we need somebody or something the most, it just happens to fall into place. And somebody, Sharon in the chat room, I'm going to ask this real quick. She says, Catherine, have you ever experienced or see anything remotely like Betty and Barney? And that was one of my questions, is why did you feel like it was a responsibility of yours to take this up and, you know, write a book and do the research and get the story, keep the story going?
Well, initially, back in the 1980s, I was reading articles written by Carl Sagan, for example. I was watching shows on television about the case mm-hmm. as well. And what they were writing and stating didn't have the ring of truth. And from my memory, so what I decided to do is that I was going to do a very thorough investigation and analysis of all of this. It took me 14 years. And I was a terrible typist, but I typed out all of those hours and hours of hypnosis tapes. I had all of the original files because Betty was my aunt and we had a close relationship. So I had all of the letters to and from scientists, the Air Force reports, everything written about the star map, you name it. There was a great deal of information there. And I did my own investigation. Betty and I went up to that close encounter route time and time again, driving along it. I even tape recorded what she stated, what she was describing as we went along. And we went to the abduction site too. They found the abduction site in 1965, and I was with them when they found that. We were camping up there, my grandparents, my mother, and I, and Betty and Barney for the weekend. And, you know, they had looked for years for that site. They started traveling up in 1961. They remembered exactly what it looked like under hypnosis. And then they finally found it on Labor Day of 1965. So that was a huge achievement in doing that. Because Dr. Simon told them that if this was real, they'd be able to find where they were abducted. And they finally did.
And I'm sure it made them feel
Do I feel compelled to?
Right.
Because I wanted to know the truth.
Right.
I even drove the entire route with my husband that Betty and Barney took on the same roads that they drove on. Much later, of course, but by that time I had memorized the hypnosis tapes and was just looking at the things and that Barney and Betty were describing as they were driving along, and Dr. Simon had them hypnotized separately. He reinstated amnesia, going back to the beginning, the decision to go on that trip to begin with. So I did a comparative analysis of their statements, because some of these skeptics were writing that Betty had a series of dreams, and that she just relived her dreams under hypnosis, and Barney had overheard her telling people about her dreams over and over again. So he absorbed that information and repeated it as if it were his own story, because he was such a weak man that he would believe and say anything that Betty wanted. A civil rights leader married to a white woman in 1960 is a weak man.
Yeah, I don't think
Valerie Cunningham. Valerie Cunningham, who is an African-American historian, knew Barney. And she said that Barney was fearless, and I'm trying to remember the second word, brave or something like that.
Because you said he was walking towards it. So a weak man would have turned and drove as fast as he could the first time he saw something.
To the nearest hotel.
Right. Was it near, and EZE417 in the chat room says, is that close to any military bases around there?
There was a military radar installation 17 miles west of where Betty and Barney saw the craft. And then Pease Air Force Base was down on the seacoast area next to Portsmouth. Mm-hmm. It was in Newington, New Hampshire, Pease Air Force Base. And they had actually picked up two radar targets that night. One was earlier in the evening, the one in Vermont, 17 miles west of where they were. And then 2:14 a.m. with the second one that was seen coming from the Atlantic Ocean and moving west. Makes me wonder if they actually took Betty and Barney under the water.
Right.
As they thought, Betty and Barney always thought that the craft just remained there on the ground where they were taken.
Well, and like you said, and your Aunt Betty, when did she pass away? I can't remember. 2000 and...
In 2004.
So she lived quite a bit longer. After your Uncle Barney passed away, what experiences did she have? Did she ever get revisited? Did she have, you know, flashbacks of, you know, how sometimes throughout the years, you know, even if somebody's been in an abusive childhood situation, years later they have flashbacks of what actually happened when they didn't remember it throughout the years. Did she ever have that come up?
Well, she had additional experiences that were never made public.
Oh, she did?
Yes. Yeah. It's in her records.
Mm-hmm.
She would speak to me privately about it a little bit. She was hypnotized by Dr. James Harder from the University of California, Berkeley, who was the head investigator for APRO. And she spoke about being visited about once a year.
Really? Do you think abducted once a year or just visited?
Well, what's the difference?
Yeah, I guess true. That is true.
It's yeah. a matter.
Right. So why do you think, or why did she ever feel like, why me? Because it is, you know, well, back then, maybe 5 billion people in the world. Why her? Why Barney? Because it seems like they choose these people for some reason.
Right.
Was it for her intelligence?
Well, I think that it might have had something to do with Betty being a generational experiencer.
Right.
I'm beginning to believe that now. She didn't know it. I think during her lifetime, she thought that event in 1961 was the first time, and she thought that she and Barney were picked up because they were driving through a very rural area late at night, and there weren't many other cars on the road. It was the off season in upstate New Hampshire. That's different today.
Right.
It's busy during the off season, but back then it was not. And they stopped the car and looked at the craft. So she thought that the craft had interest in them because they were showing interest in the craft.
So tell us your meeting and how this really helped your research with the amazing Stanton.
Yes. Well, I met Stanton for the first time in 1971 or 1972. I graduated from the University of New Hampshire in 1971. But I think that we took a year off. I got married and we took a year off before we went to Cincinnati to graduate school. My first husband was studying for his doctorate in the philosophy of psychiatry. So Stanton went to the university and did a lecture. And of course, I knew who he was, and Betty said, told us about it, and we went to hear Stanton's lecture. And so I knew who he was for many years, but I was working on this book. I had started out writing Betty's biography, but so much of it had to do with UFOs and what I was learning in all of this research that I was doing, that I was writing this as well. And I had a manuscript, and I had a big challenge, and that was I didn't want to investigate the star map. I'm a researcher who investigates everything very thoroughly. And Stanton was the first person to publish on the star map. He knew my aunt very well. And so at the MUFON UFO Symposium in 2005, I believe it was, it might have been 2004, but I think it was 2005, I approached him. And I asked, told him that I was writing this book and all of the work I had done. And I wanted to know if he was interested in joining me in writing this book. So he said, well, I can't give you an answer now, but I will drive down to your house when I have time, and I will look at all of your files and we'll talk. And then I'll make a decision. So he did finally drive down. He spent a few days with my husband and myself, and went through all the files. I let him photocopy my files. So he probably up in New Brunswick has a Betty and Barney Hill file as well. And I let him copy the star map and all of the records pertaining to the star map that Marjorie Fish finally identified after several years. So that was the part. The star map was going to take me probably a couple of years, I thought, because it took Marjorie so long to find a match. And I thought that I was going to have to then, you know, become an amateur astronomer to do that work. I didn't want to do it. My background's in social science. I had done this investigation this way. And finally, Stanton, we talked, and Stanton said to me at my house, well, you're being unbiased and scientific in your approach, and therefore I have decided to join you.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah, so it was great.
And as they say, the rest is history.
Yeah, so we've been working together since, had been working together since 2005.
Yeah, like I said, I've met you both at Roswell, I think the 70th anniversary, and it was such a pleasure. And, you know, now sadly he's passed away, but his work will always be important to, you know, all of us and all of what we do. And just because of time, I want to kind of jump into asking, in the last 40, almost 50 years that you really kind of been researching this, but 60 years of knowledge of through your aunt and through your mother, what views have changed about aliens, UFOs, that maybe was once thought, but now you know a little more facts that you can tell the audience that what aliens' purposes are, you may or may not know? And do you think in our lifetime we will ever get that full disclosure?
I know what they have told experiencers. I've worked on three major studies, one with 75 participants, which had a 25-person control group of non-experiencers for comparison. Another one was the Edgar Mitchell Free Foundation's study, I was a research consultant and helped to write the first questionnaire. And then MUFON's experience or research that I and several members of our team who had doctorates and one with a master's degree worked on for over a three-year period. So we had open-ended questions and we learned a lot from that. I'm a person who is scientifically oriented. And so when I do something, I kind of shy away from what my hypnosis clients might say, for example, because I think that I could be subjective in that way. And it's very important to me to keep my own private information private and to the public to present the objective, unbiased, factual information. But, you know, when I started as an investigator, I was very much a nuts and bolts investigator. I thought that these were metallic craft, technologically advanced, but had probably come from one star system, hopped off to another one and stayed there. And maybe over a few lifetimes, finally, through exploration, made it to planet Earth. That's what I thought in that time frame. Right. And I thought in way back in 1961 that Betty and Barney were the only ones who had ever been abducted. And I thought that for quite a few years and still until probably the 1970s. When Travis Walton and Charlie Hickson, Calvin Parker, and three women from Kentucky, and all of those people's abductions went public. But still, I was thinking of it in that time frame as nuts and bolts. And then I thought of the paranormal phenomena that is definitely part and parcel of the abduction phenomena. I thought of that as being two separate things. Somebody had ghosts in their house, well, and then they happened to have a UFO abduction, but they're completely unrelated. Light orbs. That is one of the most prevalent things in the homes of abductees, of experiencers. Let me use that term. I don't like the term abductee. So, and also, very high percentage say that they had the sensation of something unseen walking on the bed. And, you know, so back when that happened to me, I was married at the time, staying back visiting my mother in New Hampshire, and she had cleaned out all of the children's bedrooms, and so she didn't have a bed that would fit two people except for her own. So my husband and I stayed in her room, and she slept on a rollaway bed in one of the bedrooms that we had when we were kids. And during the night, my husband and I got woken up by something that was walking on the bed, and we thought that my mother's cat was in the room. So we turned on the light, we looked everywhere for the cat, we couldn't find the cat, turned the light back off, and there's these footprints on the bed again. And then and felt down for it, no cat there, but the indentations were there. That was very strange. And so we asked my mother about it the next day, and she said, "Oh yes, that's my ghost cat." But you know, it makes me wonder, my mother was an experiencer too. So that I'm wondering if this was just, you know, ETs maybe.
Was she intuitive? Like, have a little a psychic ability? Your mother?
My mom? I believe so. Yeah.
Yeah. And it sounded like it.
One of the major characteristics of experiencers that we all undergo major changes, and according to our studies, we become different people than we were before. we develop a higher level of intelligence than we had. We have more knowledge than we had. We have developed psychic ability or intuition. Mm-hmm. We become more spiritual, highly spiritual. We perceive the world differently than we had previously, sort of as one world, one people, and have interest in preserving the health of our planet through environmental work to against pollution.
Right.
We become anti-nuclear.
Maybe that was me, because I all my life since I've been young, I was like that. Like young, that was my thought.
Well, the ETs show people over and over again nuclear destruction, fires, the nuclear bomb, people's faces melting off, terrible, terrible scenes, and you know, they telepathically say that they have seen other planets where the population advanced to the level that we are at now.
Destroy themselves.
And they destroy themselves. And they don't want that to happen to us. So with all of the experiencers, they want us to spread that message. Only if they wanted to, then why aren't we remembering it? Why do we have to undergo hypnosis to remember that?
Right.
That doesn't make sense to me, unless they don't know us as well as we think they do.
Maybe, you know, it's like some people, I always say, communicating by saying someone, I love you and I love you. I mean, there's the way somebody says it. Maybe we interpret it differently than how they perceive that we're going to.
Yes.
Receive it.
Yeah, that could be. I mean, some people just thought that the ETs were trying to frighten them, elicit a fear response.
I was going to say, just showing themselves, they wouldn't even have to abduct them. I'm sure showing themselves would have scared them enough.
Right. Yes, well, it does.
For those abductees, and like even I, maybe my sister was abducted, I don't know. But for those people that never really realized that they were abducted, or they're getting flashbacks of something, they just don't know what it is. What would you suggest they do? I mean, not everybody can go get hypnotized or under hypnosis, but what can somebody do to help reveal this information?
Well, I have written a book for experiencers, and it's titled Extraterrestrial Contact: What to Do When You've Been Abducted. And so it's a comprehensive guide for experiencers with question and answers at the end of every chapter to help experiencers to work through this, suggestions on how to remember more, information on the different stages that experiencers go through, from realizing it happened, but then questioning yourself, being in denial, moving ahead a little bit, and then moving back again, ahead and back. And, you know, till you finally come to the point where you learn more and you can accept this. And, you know, I don't care about the investigations. There have been enough investigations of this by field investigators that they know what's going on, or they should know what's going on. I care about experiencers. Mm-hmm. And this book is written for experiencers. How to investigate your own contact experiences. I've written some stories in there about experiencers that I've worked with. Everything from a wonderful experience where the experiencer was had cancer and was taken and healed by the ETs, to a really kind of uncomfortable and negative experiences where a man might have been abducted. I'm not even positive of that, but he did actually, he was a retired pilot who opened up his own little airport. And the UFOs were coming in, and he ended up being taken He was almost 50 years old when that happened. And then there was demonic activity or negative entities involved. And I don't believe that the really negative ones are actually extraterrestrials. Mm. Why would they do that?
Right.
How would they have survived to do that?
I could talk to you all day. We have so much more to talk about, but we'll have to have you back for a part two. And for the people that want more information about you, of course, you can go to Kathleen-Marden, MARDEN.com. Tell us, I know you were telling me before the show, you have some appearances you're going to be doing this year in person. Woohoo!
Yes, I'm going tell to us be about talking it. About the 60th anniversary of Betty's and Barney's experience. And the reason for this is we have a different one now. You can see it. It has that ribbon at the top.
60th.
And the reason for that is it's not the old book. It is updated with new information, new scientific studies that have been done. And it's really exciting information. So I'm going to be speaking at Roswell, at Exeter, New Hampshire, hopefully. And that's in September. Roswell is in July. And then in September, in upstate Michigan, as well at an experiencer conference where I'll be showing some photographs of extraterrestrials. So that have been verified. So that's exciting. And I'm looking forward to that. I just can't wait to break out of this house.
Right. Me too. Well, yeah. We thank you so much. And it's always a pleasure to have you on the show. And I'm going to be, of course, part of Contact in the Desert this coming year, this year. So make sure you guys get your tickets for June 25th through 28th. It's all virtual this year. But next year, they plan on having it in person. So we're going to be doing a lot of interviews for Contact in the Desert. So please, as you can see, there, you know, George Norrie, Linda Moulton Howe, Eric Von Daniken, the list goes on and on and on. And so please get your tickets. We're actually going to be giving some tickets away on Truth Be Told for the virtual online stuff. So Kathleen, thank you so much.
It was my pleasure.
All right, everybody. Please follow us on our Instagram. It's Truth Be Told Paranormal right below here. Subscribe to our YouTube channel. Share the show. We want to spread this word about the 60th anniversary of the Betty and Barney Hill UFO experience. So please share the show. And we always thank you for tuning in every week, being part of the chat room, and keeping us going. So until then, I'm Tony Sweet for Truth Be Told. Kathleen. Talk to you soon. Bye-bye.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on chumbacasino.com. I looked over the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's chumbacasino.com and live the Chumba life.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.